From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cheri Gross with Fresh Air.
Come on along and listen to the lullaby of Broadway.
This song won an Academy Award 60 years ago. This year's Academy Awards will be given out Monday night. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, three of this year's nominees for Best Supporting Actor will feature interviews with Samuel Jackson, nominated for his role in Pulp Fiction, Chaz Palminteri, nominated for Bullets Over Broadway, and Gary Sinise for Forrest Gump. Also today, Lord Schwartz reviews a new 5-CD box set of Oscar-winning songs, including Lullaby of Broadway. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie, Losing Isaiah, which co-stars one of today's guests, Samuel Jackson. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
Sleep tight, let's all live the day. Oh, come on along.
First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The House of Representatives has passed a massive welfare reform bill. It's featured in the Republicans' Contract with America. It dramatically changes care for the poor by transferring the responsibility from the federal government to the states. Republicans say the current system is flawed and corrupt. Democrats charge the GOP is cruel to children, and savings from the poverty programs will finance tax breaks for the rich. The only survivor of this week's post office robbery in Montclair, New Jersey, is expected to fully recover. Steve Inskeep of member station WBGO reports.
Doctors say the gunman shot David Grossman a total of three times in the face and neck and left him beside the bodies of two other postal customers and two employees. But the bullets missed Grossman's brain, and he has now begun 10 days of reconstructive surgery. Doctors say he will fully recover. His wife, Karen Abarbanal, says Grossman still can't speak, but he remains conscious.
He is very distressed that that he is the only one to come out of this alive.
After the shooting on Tuesday, Grossman signaled information to police by wiggling his right foot in answer to questions. A suspect was arrested the next day. Police say Christopher Green has confessed to robbing the post office of $5,000 to pay his debts, and Green faces a bail hearing on Monday. For National Public Radio, I'm Steve Inskeep in Newark, New Jersey.
Former Pennsylvania Governor Robert Casey has decided to formally explore the prospects of a 1996 presidential bid. Robbie Harris of member station WHYY reports from Philadelphia.
If he decides to run, the former two-term governor of Pennsylvania would be the first Democrat to challenge President Bill Clinton's reelection. Robert Casey has been floating the idea of challenging Clinton ever since he left office in January, after serving two consecutive terms. During his tenure, Casey became known as a strong foe of abortion. On this, he differs strongly with the president, and his candidacy could offer an option for anti-abortion voters. Casey spokeswoman Karen Walsh says he plans to file names of an official exploratory committee with the Federal Election Commission today. But Walsh says Casey has made no formal decision at this point about whether he will seek the presidency. For National Public Radio, I'm Robbie Harris in Philadelphia.
A House panel is holding hearings on affirmative action. They are debating whether the programs are still needed. Republican Chairman Harris Faywell says Americans want a colorblind society and affirmative action is reverse discrimination. But Missouri Democrat William Clay says discrimination still exists. He points out that blacks lag far behind whites in wages and jobs. Assistant Attorney General Deval Patrick agrees. The Clinton administration's top civil rights lawyer says the White House is reviewing affirmative action programs, but it remains committed to equal opportunity for all Americans. On Wall Street, the Dow is up nearly 50 points at 4,137. This is NPR. President Clinton took a five-hour physical exam today at the Naval Medical Center in Bethesda, Maryland. The White House says the president has no particular health concerns that need to be raised. Last year's physical found the president in excellent health, although bothered by allergies and a slightly higher than normal cholesterol level. Republican Senator Dan Coats of Indiana and Democrat Joseph Lieberman of Connecticut are again introducing a bill that sets up a test program for the use of school vouchers. NPR's Carol Ann Clark Kelly reports.
The senators have tried three times before to get fellow lawmakers to approve a test of school vouchers, but they're confident that this new Congress will give the idea a fresh look. Republican Dan Coats says the measure would set up 10 to 20 demonstration programs targeted at low-income families.
We are not attempting here to subsidize the suburban family who already has a choice based on their income of where they send their children to school. What we're trying to do is extend that choice to families whose income status does not allow them any choice.
The proposal carries a price tag of $30 million. It's running into opposition from the National Education Association, which argues that the voucher programs will ultimately drain the resources of public schools. I'm Carol Ann Clark Kelly in Washington.
A Japanese religious sect is suing Japanese police. The group is protesting this week's raids on its buildings. The suit asks for $300,000 in damages. Japanese police have conducted a third day of raids on sect buildings around Japan in the wake of Monday's nerve gas attack on the Tokyo subway system. Authorities have found hundreds of barrels of chemicals used to make and neutralize nerve gas. The group's leader denies the chemicals could be used to make the nerve gas that killed 10 subway passengers. But one chemical expert says the sect had enough ingredients to produce a nightmarish quantity of chemical weapons. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Academy Awards will be handed out Monday night. On this archive edition of our show, we feature interviews with three of the nominees for Best Supporting Actor: Chaz Palminteri, nominated for his role in Bullets Over Broadway, Gary Sinise for Forrest Gump, and Samuel Jackson for his role in Pulp Fiction as Jules, a hitman who quotes the Bible to his victims.
Ezekiel 25:17. The path of the righteous man is beset on all sides by the iniquities of the selfish and the tyranny of evil men. Blessed is he who in the name of charity and goodwill shepherds the weak through the valley of darkness, for he is truly his brother's keeper and the finder of lost children. And I will strike down upon thee with great vengeance and furious anger those who attempt to poison and destroy my brothers. And you will know my name is the Lord when I lay my vengeance upon thee.
Pulp Fiction has nominations in most of the top categories: Best Film, Best Director, Best Actor, and Supporting Actor and Actress. I spoke with Samuel Jackson in 1991 after he played a crack addict in Spike Lee's Jungle Fever. The judges at that year's Cannes Film Festival liked Jackson's performance so much, they gave him a special award for Best Supporting Actor. In Jungle Fever, Jackson's character, Gator, is driven by his addiction. The only time he sees his family is when he's hitting them up for money. Here he is trying to wear down his architect brother, Flipper, played by Wesley Snipes.
Look at here. I'm a little light, though.
Yep. What, you didn't get your check from Soul Train yet?
Don lost my address. Come on, hit me. Get some cash in my hand.
Gator does his dance when he asks anyone in his family for money. I asked Samuel Jackson the story behind this dance.
Well, actually, it's written in the script. That was Spike's idea, but I had to make up the dances. I assume, or I judge by the way that I used to do things at my house. When my mom had her friends over, they would always call me in to do the new dances for them. And there would be older ladies sitting there watching you do the twist or the jerk or something.
Right.
Talking about how that would ruin their back if they did it.
That's right.
And it was a form of acceptance and performance that always garnered you praise and sometimes, you know, monetary recompense of some sort. You know, the ladies would give you quarters, dimes, whatever. And I'm sure that his mother did that very same thing. And they danced together. So he uses that. It seems to be something he knows that works, and that's what he uses.
Do you know people who are crack addicted, or have you run into a lot of people on the street who are?
Yes, I have, and I do, and I did. All of those. I knew people who were addicted, I know people who are addicted, and I know people who are in recovery, and all of that. And in talking to them and talking to drug counselors, I discovered that using drugs usually cuts off your emotional growth. So I stopped Gator's emotional growth at about 16. So that when he reacts to things, he reacts to things as a 16-year-old. He wants what he wants when he wants it, kind of like a baby. And in doing that, it leads to a certain amount of vulnerability and not having a lot of coping skills in the world. So he reverts to that dance, rather than his own wiles.
Did your part in Jungle Fever give you a new understanding for our empathy with addicts?
Well, I always had that. I had a roommate who was a heroin addict in college. I've always had friends who were involved in drugs, drug trade, or in an addicted state. Even in my early, my formative years, even in my formative years, I knew those people because I lived in a neighborhood in Tennessee that was kind of an alcoholic neighborhood. So it was the drug of the day was alcohol at that period. And we had a neighborhood drunk. There were lots of people in my neighborhood who sold bootleg liquor. So I saw people who were drunk all the time. That was another kind of addiction. And I had friends who drank from an early age throughout school. And then I knew people who did pills when it was time to do pills. And I guess during the 60s, I did all the things that all the people of my generation did during the 60s. So I had my own drug experiences at that time with marijuana and all the other things that passed through that era. And you just outgrow them. I did, but some people don't.
Do you think that there's a difference between your portrayal of Gator the crack addict in Jungle Fever and how you'd be expected to play that role or what you'd think of playing that role if it was in, say, a crime series on TV or a big budget action film? Do you know what I mean? Where you wouldn't be the main character, you'd just be like a sidebar character who's like the crack addict.
Well, you only get a chance to see addictive behavior in those kinds of films. I had a chance in this film to take Gator out of the stereotypical addict role where you either see him nodding or being totally crazy. So you had a chance to get into Gator the person, Gator the human being, and not just Gator the junkie, someone you don't care about at all or have no feelings about one way or another. Most of the time, those characters pass through films and they're props more than anything else. And since Spike was accused of not addressing the drug issue in any of his other films, I guess he attacked it with a vengeance this time and made sure that there were things going on.
Have you had to play more generic kind of roles in TV or in movies? You know,
Yeah, well, I've been cast as Black Man in Sea of Love. That was my name. No, it was Black Guy in Sea of Love. That was the character name.
Is that what it said in the credits?
That's what it says in the credits, Black Guy. So I guess you could say I have. But I always try to make those characters memorable. People always remember me from the things that I do. It's back to my friends calling me King of the Cameos because I pass through films and kind of leave my impression. They always remember me.
Now, didn't you spend a couple of years on TV as Bill Cosby's stand-in?
Not on TV, actually.
That's right.
I got to do
the set.
Yeah, on the set. We had a whole stand-in family, and we would go in and actually, we did. We were the junior Huxtables, I guess. And we would watch them rehearse the show right down the blocking, which is the way they move around the set. And on Wednesdays in the mornings, we would go in and actually do the whole show the way they did it so that they could plot out their camera shots and camera moves. And I wore Bill's clothes over my clothes because he's larger than I am so that the lights would be correct and they could get their color palette down. And I did that for 2.5 years, actually, and never got on the show. Well, actually, I did. Every time they show an exterior shot of people walking down the street outside their house, that's me and this other girl who was a stand-in, and we walked past each other. That's the only time I was ever on that show.
So as the stand-in for Cosby, you must have spent a lot of time sitting on the couch making jokes and being wise.
Yeah.
That's kind of how he spends the show.
Yeah. I imitated him quite well, so I did that for a while. And it was fun. It was kind of like taking a how to act on TV course for free and being paid at the same time.
Now, in Spike Lee's movie School Days, you mm-hmm. played a townie who was really hostile to the students
right.
who'd arrived from out of town.
Leeds. He had a name. Leeds, L-E-E-D-S.
Thank you.
Yes.
But you yourself were not a townie. You were a college student and went went to...
What did you say, colored or college? What did you say?
College.
Oh, okay.
You were a college student.
I'm just kidding.
Oh.
All right.
Yeah, you were a colored student.
Yes.
Yeah. Now,
Okay, but back to your question. Yeah. Yes, I was not a townie. No, I was not a townie. Yes, I went to Morehouse.
No, but yes.
Spike cast me in that role specifically because for a long time, my freshman year in college, this was before Spike's time, but I think Bill Nunn told him about it, the fellow who played Radio Raheem.
Yeah.
Well, Billy's a good friend of mine. But my freshman year at Morehouse, I actually hung out with the Block Boys. That was what we called them, not townies, but Block Boys. I actually hung out with them, and they didn't know that I went to college for about 6 months.
Oh, were you hiding that from them?
Not really, but I used to be with them when they were robbing college students and beating them up. And so they didn't really know I was one of them until they saw me at a dance one night and I had on some Morehouse gear or something. They're like, you go to Slim, you actually go to college? It's like, yeah. And it kind of changed their image of the Morehouse guys, and they didn't beat them up so often.
Oh, so you were really performing the role of Good Samaritan here.
I don't, well, that wasn't my purpose. Actually, what happened was when I got to college, my mom dropped me off there and I saw a basketball court up the street, and I played basketball a lot then. And I went up to the basketball court and I bought a quart of beer. And I asked who was up next, and I played with them. And they just assumed that I had moved in the neighborhood because I was there every day and a long time, most of the day. And they just assumed I was one of them. And I hung out with them like I was.
So what kinds of things would they say about the college students?
Well, they were stuck up. They were what they called sadiddy. They actually thought, well, a lot of them did think they were better than, and we were taught that we were better than also by the administration of the school. We were told that we were in the top 10% of the Black race who was going to lead everybody out of darkness into the light, and that Morehouse men were, at that time, more something like 75% of all the doctors in America were Morehouse men, and Morehouse men were publishers, editors. They were the leaders of the race. So a lot of them really believed that, and they didn't speak to them. The guys would just say hello, and they wouldn't speak back. And that would be cause for a beating or another attitude to flare up, or they would run them back to campus, mainly because they wouldn't speak. They ignored those people who lived in the community. Like, they invaded these people's community and felt that they were there to run it, and that wasn't the truth.
Were you ever in the position where you were with your friends and they were robbing a college student who you happened to know?
Yeah.
So what happened?
Nothing. He looked at me, and before he could say anything, somebody hit him. And by that time, they took his stuff and we left. And as a result of that, I ended up in the dean's office because the guy did recognize me and he did report the robbery and did say that I was with him. And as a consequence of that, I was put on probation a few times because I refused to identify the people who did it.
Right. Did it ever bother you that they were doing that?
No.
Why not?
Because they were actually, well, 90% of the time, they were correct, and the person that they were taking the stuff from could afford to have it taken. And they were people with petty bourgeois ideas who needed a lesson like that in reality.
Speaking of petty bourgeois,
mm-hmm.
Now I understand that when you were in college, that you were one of the people who held some of the trustees hostage.
Yeah.
So what were the issues?
The issues were that there weren't any student representatives on the trustee board. There weren't any community representatives because we were right in the middle of this community, and these people should have a say in what kinds of things go on around them. There weren't enough Black faculty members. We wanted more Black studies because there weren't any at the school. We were trying to change some of the policies. And Charles Merrill, who was the head of the trustee board at that time, told them we were absolutely correct. But it was these quote-unquote men who were trying to make us these perfect Negroes who thought we were upsetting their apple cart. And they told us that we were the kinds of people that they never should have let in Morehouse in the first place. We were more or less an experiment in the kinds of people that they let in when my class came in. And we turned out to be just what they thought.
So did your radical politics go along with a radical sense of theater at the time?
Yeah. Well, no, I wasn't even doing theater then.
Oh.
Actually, I was just a student.
Oh, so you can't call this guerrilla theater then?
Well, that didn't happen until I came back to school in 71, second semester of 71. And that's when I started my theater major in earnest. And aside from the Morehouse Spelman Players, which was our proper theater in school where we did all our school productions, we had our own theater company, the Black Image Theater Company. That was our Hate Whitey Revolutionary Theater. Where we did all those kinds of revolutionary poems and skits about the supremacists. We had like a singing group that was like the Supremes, but we were called the Supremacists. And we sang racist tunes. And we did all those Die Nigger poems so black folk can take over, you know, New Nation poems. And people were paying us to do that stuff. We were traveling all over. We were going to Tulane and Florida State and all kinds of big white schools. And they were like, yes, yes, denigrate us, yes, do it. And we enjoyed it. It was great fun.
Samuel Jackson, recorded in 1991. He's nominated for Best Supporting Actor for his role in Pulp Fiction. He also co-stars in the new film Losing Isaiah and in the remake of Kiss of Death, which opens next month. 60 years of Academy Award-winning songs are collected in a new CD box set. We'll have a review after this break. This is Fresh Air. The first Oscars were presented in 1928, but it wasn't until 1934 that an Oscar was given for Best Song. The first song to win was The Continental from The Gay Divorcee. Now you can hear the winning songs from the past 60 years in a new 5-CD box set put out by Rhino Records. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review.
Thanks for the memory of sentimental verse. Nothing in my purse, and chuckles when the preacher said, for better or for worse. How lovely it was.
Bob Hope made his Hollywood feature film debut in the big broadcast of 1938. One of the high points was a duet he sang with the endearing Shirley Ross, who played one of his ex-wives. Thanks for the Memory, of course, became Hope's theme song. But it's useful to remember that in the movie, the song was a response to a particular context. Thanks for the Memory is surely the most touching and civilized song ever written about a divorce.
We said goodbye with a highball. Then I got as high as a steeple.
Did you?
But we were intelligent people.
No tears, no fuss.
Hooray for us.
Strictly entre-nous, darling, how are you?
And how are all those little dreams that never did come true?
Awfully glad I met you.
Cheerio and toodaloo. Thank you so much.
9 other songs were nominated for an Oscar in 1938, including such eventual standards as Irving Berlin's Change Partners and Jeepers Creepers by Harry Warren and Johnny Mercer. Berlin would later get the Oscar for White Christmas. Warren had already won for Lullaby of Broadway. And Johnny Mercer would go on to win 4 Oscars. Jerome Kern, Dorothy Fields, Harold Arlen, Rodgers and Hammerstein, Frank Lesser, Lerner and Lowe, and Stephen Sondheim all won Oscars. But neither Cole Porter nor George and Ira Gershwin ever did. John Lennon and Paul McCartney never even got nominated. In 1937, one of the Gershwin's greatest songs, They Can't Take That Away From Me, lost out to a Hawaiian number called Sweet Leilani, sung in the film Waikiki Wedding by the phenomenally popular Bing Crosby, one of 4 Crosby hits to receive Oscars. Harold Arlen and Ira Gershwin's The Man That Got Away, from the 1954 Judy Garland version of A Star Is Born, is my nomination for one of the greatest musical numbers in film history. It lost to the pretty but innocuous Three Coins in the Fountain, which was the first Oscar-winning song written for a movie's title credits, and one of three winners associated with Frank Sinatra. As Fats Waller said, one never knows, do one? About half the winners are conventional love songs like The Way You Look Tonight or All the Way. But there are just as many catchy novelties like On the Atchison, Topeka and the Santa Fe or Zippity-Doo-Dah, one of six winners from Disney films. I especially like the songs that play a part in the dramatic or emotional situation of a film, like Over the Rainbow, Baby It's Cold Outside, or Que Sera Sera, the only Oscar-winning song from an Alfred Hitchcock movie. Tex Ritter's great title ballad for High Noon is a distillation of the film's archetypal conflicts. It's one of the main reasons people took this Western so seriously.
Do not forsake me, oh my darling. On this our wedding day, do not forsake me, oh my darling. Wait long. I do not know what fate awaits me. I only know I must be brave, and I must face a man who hates me. A liar coward, a craven coward, a liar coward in my grave.
In recent years, the competition has been pretty feeble, though there are happy surprises like Stevie Wonder's I Just Called to Say I Love You, or Bruce Springsteen's powerful AIDS anthem, Streets of Philadelphia. You can hear all 60 Oscar winners on the new Rhino set, many but not all of them recorded by their original performers or composers. Unfortunately, because of licensing problems, we get no Sinatra, Shore, Streisand, or Springsteen. An 80-page booklet full of interviews and fascinating information helps distract from what's missing. After all, popular songs can reveal as much about their times as headlines.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed The Envelope, Please, Academy Award-winning songs on Rhino Records. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. More on the Academy Awards in the second part of our show.
Lemon drops away above the chimney tops. That's where you
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Academy Awards will be presented Monday night. Coming up on this archive edition, we continue our interviews with some of this year's nominees for Best Supporting Actor. We'll hear from Chaz Palminteri, nominated for his role as a gangster in Bullets Over Broadway, and Gary Sinise, nominated for his role as a disabled and bitter Vietnam veteran in Forrest Gump. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie Losing Isaiah. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The House of Representatives has passed its massive welfare overhaul bill. The hotly contested legislation passed by a vote of 234 to 199. The measure turns most control of poverty programs over to states. Republicans say the Personal Responsibility Act will free the nation's poor from an endless cycle of poverty. They say it puts an end to layers of wasteful federal bureaucracy and saves $66 billion in the first 5 years. Democrats charged the GOP with cutting poverty programs drastically to win political points. The White House has again blasted Republican plans to cut taxes. A spokesman says the GOP's plan would rob poor Americans and reward wealthy ones. UPI's Bill Small reports.
Chief of Staff Leon Panetta says a new study by the Budget Office has confirmed White House criticism of the GOP tax cut plan, showing, he says, that most of the costs are borne by families making $50,000 a year or less, while most of the benefits go to families making $200,000 or more.
What you have here is obviously a major redistribution of income in the wrong direction. If anything, it is, instead of trickle down, it is trickle up.
Panetta stops just short of issuing a veto threat on the tax cut plan, saying only that Mr. Clinton is strongly opposed to it and hopes the Senate version will be better. Bill Small at the White House.
A soldier from Fort Drum, New York, faces a court-martial for leaving his post in Haiti last year to investigate reports of human rights abuses. Chris Ulanowski of member station WRVO reports.
Army Captain Lawrence Rockwood says he was morally justified for following up on reports of human rights abuses. But Major General David Meade, the commander of the 10th Mountain Division at Fort Drum, has decided Rockwood will be tried for his actions. Rockwood admits he left his post for an unauthorized inspection of a jail in Port-au-Prince. The Army says he disobeyed orders. But Rockwood, a 15-year career officer, remains defiant. He says the important thing is to change the military culture so an officer who encounters abuses can report them without fear of retribution. The most serious charges against Rockwood carries a penalty of 2 years in prison. For National Public Radio, I'm Chris Ulanowski in Oswego, New York.
A published report says a problem with a tax preparation computer program has left thousands of tax returns vulnerable to tampering. The New York Times is quoting the Intuit company as saying it fixed the problem within hours of learning of it yesterday. The Times says Intuit accidentally left within the program a way for computer users to dial into a central computer. The central computer contained tax returns of Intuit customers. Some 60,000 returns are stored there waiting for processing. Intuit says there's no evidence of tampering, but they're not sure it didn't happen. On Wall Street, the Dow climbed more than 50 points to close at another record, 41.38. This is NPR. Russian troops reportedly are closing in on the last rebel stronghold in Chechnya. Russian forces have already captured the rebel-held town of Argun. Now they're attacking Shaly, a town south of Argun. The BBC's Robert Parsons reports from Moscow.
By seizing Argun on Thursday, the Russians have significantly tightened their noose around the Chechen forces still fighting them further to the south. The lightly armed Chechens had resisted the Russian army and air force for almost 3 months, but chose in the end to melt away rather than face a suicidal confrontation with a better armed opponent. The fate of Argun was sealed when Russian tanks encircled it earlier in the week. Its capture will make it much easier for the Russians to supply their forces by rail from the east. They will now focus their attention on Shaly, about 10 kilometers to the south, which has been the center of Chechen resistance since the fall of Grozny. After initial setbacks, the war in Chechnya is undoubtedly going Russia's way. But despite that, its senior commanders are under no illusions about the size of the task still ahead.
Robert Parsons reporting. Cray Computer Corporation, rather Computer Corporation, a fledgling maker of supercomputers, has filed for bankruptcy protection. The Colorado Springs-based firm says it cannot finish selling $20 million of common stock needed to finance a new supercomputer system. Cray Computer Corporation does not have a direct relationship to Cray Research Incorporated, which is the largest maker of supercomputers. The bankruptcy petition has been filed in federal court in Colorado. A published report says United Parcel Service is cutting 2,000 management jobs to reduce costs. The Wall Street Journal says the jobs will be cut over the next 18 months. It's not clear if the cuts will be made through attrition, buyouts, or layoffs. The Journal says there are some 35,000 managers in the UPS workforce. More responsibility will reportedly be given to drivers and sorters. The company plans to rely on more new technology. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After years of acting obscurity, Chaz Palminteri is doing good. He's nominated for an Academy Award for his role in Woody Allen's Bullets Over Broadway. Palminteri plays a small-time gangster forced to babysit his boss's actress girlfriend. She's a lousy actress, preparing for a part the director was strong-armed into giving her. Here's Palminteri in a scene where he's reluctantly rehearsing with her. She's played by Jennifer Tilly, who is, by the way, nominated for Best Supporting Actress, as is her co-star in Bullets, Diane Wiest.
Can't you see? You're living out the exact same pattern your mother lived out with your father.
I am? Pray tell.
In some way, you're trying to relive it, and in the process of reliving it, correct it. As if that were possible. Ha!
It don't say ha.
I don't say ha. I added that.
What do you mean you added that? Are you allowed to do that?
We're allowed to add things.
How could you just add something?
You're allowed to add things. It's called ad-libbing.
You can't do that.
I can do that. What do you know? You don't know nothing. Shut up and read.
I think the whole thing stinks,
I think you're a degenerate zombie. Shut up and read.
Shut up.
You shut up and read.
Just shut up.
You shut up.
You're lucky you're Nick's girl.
You're lucky you're an idiot.
Well, it turns out this gangster has a natural gift for writing. And there's a parallel in Palminteri's life. His acting career took off after he wrote a semi-autobiographical one-man show for himself. Inspired by the show's success, he adapted it into the film A Bronx Tale. Robert De Niro directed and co-starred with Palminteri in what turned out to be Palminteri's breakthrough role. Last fall, I talked with Palminteri about Bullets Over Broadway. I asked him if Woody Allen wrote the role for him or if he had to read for the part.
We were editing Bronx Tale at the time, Bob De Niro and myself, and then I got a call that Woody Allen wanted to meet me. So I went down to his studio. I walked in, and I said hi, and we talked for about 30 seconds. And then he said, would you mind reading a scene for me? And I said, no, not at all. I read a scene, and he said, that was it. Thank you. So I left. And I got a call about 5 days later that he would like to see me again. I went in, I walked in, and he said, how are you? I said, fine. He said, you know, would you really mind reading just one more scene for me? And I said, no, I have no problem with that at all, Woody. And I read another scene for him, and he said, thank you. And I walked out. About an hour later, they called me, and they said, I got the part.
What did you relate to in your role as Cheech, the gangster who turns out to have an incredible gift for writing?
Besides being an actor, I am a writer. So I really tuned in to Cheech. I really felt what he felt about, you know, standing his ground. I mean, that's very similar to what happened to me in A Bronx Tale, in fact. When I wrote Bronx Tale, the one-man show, and I performed it on stage, everyone loved it and all the studios wanted it, but they didn't want me in the role. They just wanted a star in the role. And so I just held my ground. The offers kept getting higher and higher, and I just still held my ground. Even when the offers reached seven figures, I still said no. Until finally, they made the movie with me, with the help of, obviously, Robert De Niro, who saw me on stage and said, hey, you would be great in the role. I'll play Lorenzo. I'll direct it. Let's make the movie.
Why did you hold out until you could star in it? Why didn't you just take the money and run?
Because this was my shot, and I was not going to let it go away. I mean, a lot of people said I was crazy, that it wasn't going to happen, that I was going to blow the whole deal, but I really believed in myself and knew that this movie was going to get made because it was just too good.
So you ended up getting the part and the money.
Yes, I did.
You did good.
That's correct.
A Bronx Tale, the movie which grew out of your one-man show, is pretty autobiographical. And it's about a boy who witnesses a murder and then refuses to talk with the police about it.
Right.
And the local mob head, and thanks to the kid for not talking to the police, takes him under his wing. And then the kid's father and the mobster kind of fight for control over the kid's mind. Did you witness a murder when you were young?
Yes, I did. I witnessed a murder when I was about 9. I sat on my stoop. Basically, just the way it happened in the movie, that's the way it happened. Except I didn't have to the cops didn't bring me down. I didn't have to witness anything. You know, I mean, I'd have to, like, point anybody out of a lineup. That I just wrote for dramatic purposes.
For our listeners who may not have seen the movie, would you describe what you saw?
I was sitting on my stoop, and there was two cars parking. They were fighting for a parking space, and one guy got out with a baseball bat and broke the window of the guy in the back trying to sneak in the space, and the other guy got out with a gun and killed him.
Now, in the movie, the kid assumes, wow, what a fight over a parking spot.
Right. I thought it was over a parking space, but years later, I found out it wasn't.
What was it about?
I never found out what it was about, but I knew it wasn't over a parking space. My father would never tell me.
So it was about some mob thing or another?
It was a street thing. God knows what it was about.
Now, did the mob guy who did the hit become your mentor, as in the movie?
No. There was basically what I did was the guy was a conglomeration of a lot of different characters that I knew, and some of myself. It was just this basic thing that I wanted to put the working man against the mafiosa and the boy in the middle.
So did you hang out with wise guys?
Yes, I did, yeah. Yeah, and back in those days in the neighborhood, everybody hung out together, Terry. It was a very unique thing. Bad guys and good guys all hung out on the corner. It was very different back then. And when one guy had to do something, he just walked away and did what he had to do. So we all kind of, like, melted into each other.
Was there anything you found seductive about that world?
Well, when you're very young, it's impressionable. You see the cars, the money, the women, the clothes. You know, you think that's what life's about. But as you get older, you realize what my father was telling me, that the working man was really the tough guy. It doesn't take much strength to pull the trigger. It, you know, takes a lot of strength to get up in the morning and work for a living.
So, you know, when you were, what, 9 when you saw the murder?
Yes.
Did it scare you? What impact did it have on you?
No, it didn't scare me. It just stayed in my... people always ask me that. It's the amazing thing was I just... When the guy killed him, he just kind of turned and stared at me. And I stared at him, and our eyes met, and he was looking at me. And, I mean, it's so long ago, and I think he was looking at me with the eyes of, like, my God, I'm sorry this kid had to see this. And that's what it felt like to me when I go back and I remember it. And then the next thing I knew, my father grabbed me by my arm and dragged me upstairs.
What did your father say to you?
He just said, my father wouldn't talk about it. He said, forget it. And I said, but Daddy, it was a parking space. What? He said, forget it. He would not talk about it. I mean, he's the old school Sicilian, you know. When something like that was done in the neighborhood, you don't talk about it.
What do you think would have happened to you if you did talk about it?
I don't know. It wouldn't have been good. I mean, we probably would have had to pack up and move. I don't know.
Have you spoken to your father about that incident?
Yes.
As an adult?
Yes.
And what?
He says still the same thing. I said, Dad, now that it's over, years have gone by, and it's a movie, and everybody knows about it, what was it about? And he still gives me the same answer. You know, things, people, stakes. He speaks in non sequiturs. You know, he still never tells me. Will not say it.
Now, how do you think he knows?
He knows. I know he knows, because I can look in his eyes, and he smiles.
Chaz Palminteri recorded last November. He's nominated for Best Supporting Actor for his role in Bullets Over Broadway. He co-stars in the film The Perez Family, which opens this May. A movie he wrote called Faithful will be released this summer. Coming up, we hear from another Academy Award nominee, Gary Sinise, co-star of Forrest Gump. This is Fresh Air. Gary Sinise used to be identified with adventurous, if not always profitable, theater productions. Last year, he co-starred in a movie box office phenomenon, Forrest Gump. Now he's up for an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor for his role in Gump as Lieutenant Dan, who's bitter about having lost his legs in Vietnam. Sinise co-founded and directed the Steppenwolf Theater Company back in 1974 at the age of 18. The company also launched the careers of John Malkovich and Laurie Metcalf. I spoke with Sinise in 1992 after he completed a film adaptation of John Steinbeck's Of Mice and Men, which he directed and starred in. Sinise once described himself as a crazy mixed-up kid who turned his life around in high school in a production of West Side Story.
True, I was kind of a screwed-up rock and roller in high school, and then me and some rock and roll buddies of mine, I played in a lot of bands, so I always did like performing, and me and some of the rock and roll guys from the band saw that they were performing West Side Story, and we thought it'd be fun to go jump around and be in a gang. So we went and tried out, and a bunch of us got in it, and all of a sudden I discovered this other thing that I really loved, and it was this teacher in high school that kind of brought that out of me and reinforced something that I guess was inside there, but I just didn't know it was there.
I know a lot of men always thought it was silly to have singing and dancing gang members. That didn't bother you?
At that time, no. I mean, there were girls in the play.
Oh, I see.
It was fun. There were all of a sudden I was dancing with girls, and girls were around, and it was a way to meet girls at that time too, you know.
So you were a shark?
I was a shark.
So what did you do to be Puerto Rican?
Makeup.
Uh-huh.
That was kind of funny because this is, you know, it's the North Shore of Chicago. There aren't a lot of Puerto Ricans up in Island Park. So, you know, we did the makeup and, you know, I was Peppy. Peppy the Shark.
So did you get any featured songs? I mean, did you get featured lines within songs?
No, I had a couple lines, you know, like bottles or knives or guns or something. Chains.
What are you going to rumble with?
Yeah, yeah, right. Rumble, rumble, rumble. I don't know what I said, but it wasn't, it was very moving. I remember, that was at a time in my life where we had just moved. We had moved around a lot, and moving as a high school kid, you know, when you're that age, you know, you're really rooted in your friends, and you're making acquaintances, and and when you move away from that, it's very difficult for a young person to, like, find a new group of friends. And so I was kind of very rebellious and not getting along well with my parents at that time. So I was having a lot of trouble in high school. I wasn't going to class, and I wasn't reading or studying or doing anything until I discovered the theater. And all of a sudden it made me want to go to school and just work in the scene shop and paint sets and hang out with these theater people that were very different from the kind of folks that I was hanging out with. And this teacher was somebody who really turned me around. You know, I can't say that I had one of those teachers that had an enormous effect on me. And all of a sudden then I was, my parents were, you know, all of a sudden because of that, I started communicating with my parents in a way that we hadn't been communicating for a while. And they started coming to see the plays, and all of a sudden the troubled kind of kid who was really looking for something, all of a sudden his family life changed and his, you know, schooling changed. I still graduated late because I was such a jerk in the early part of my high school that I didn't have enough credits. But still, I found something that really made me want to learn.
You were 18 when you co-founded Steppenwolf Theater.
Mm-hmm.
So were you still in high school then, or were you out?
I had just gotten out of high school.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I went immediately and found a church and just kept doing, you know, theater. We just asked this church if they would let us work in there at night and do theater, and they said yes, and I just kept on doing it.
Critics have used words like brave and daring to describe some of the performances in Steppenwolf Theater Company. When you directed shows, did you feel that you were really pushing people to the edge of their own capabilities? What does it mean to be brave and daring on stage?
Well, I think being stupid is part of it.
What do you mean by that?
Being kind of silly and stupid is part of it. I mean exactly that, being uninhibited enough to let anything come out and to attempt anything without restriction. And that's one of the things that, because we were isolated in this basement, and, you know, it was 20 miles north of Chicago, and there wasn't any other theater around there. It's not like we were in, you know, one of many groups in a theater community. We were isolated in this little basement in a suburb, And it was almost like we, you know, at a certain point, we didn't care who came or how they reacted. We were just doing it for ourselves. And so we were kind of rebellious and kind of idiotic, and we just, you know, there was the one time I can remember us trying to, you know, get some people into the seats and do something for the audience was a miserable failure. We thought, well, let's do a musical.
What'd you do?
We put our own musical together. It was called Mac Anything Goes Over the Rainbow, and it was a Harold Arlen, Cole Porter, and Kurt Vile songs, and it was kind of a hodgepodge of all their stuff. And we thought, well, let's make some money. Let's do a musical. You know, nobody's coming to see our axe murdering plays, and you know, these bleak things that we were doing, and you know, dangerous things. Nobody's coming, so let's do a musical. Well, I mean, you can't just do a musical. You have to be able to sing or dance or something. So it was a horrible failure. After that, we decided, let's never again attempt to do something simply for the audience that we will think will make money or be commercial or bring in a crowd, but let's just stick to our guns and do what we want. So there were many times where people just didn't show up to the plays, and I can remember we didn't care. We'd just entertain each other that night. We'd go out and get some beer and put on a play. We'd just improvise for each other and kind of do these things all night we called random nights. And we'd do a random night whenever we wouldn't get an audience, and that was quite often.
What if there was one person in the audience? Would you do the play or would you do the random night?
If there was one person in the audience, yes, we would do the play. We would ask, you know, I mean, whoever was an usher or selling tickets that night, we'd just have them go sit with that person so they wouldn't feel so bad. We'd do the show.
Gary Sinise, he's nominated for an Academy Award for his role in Forrest Gump. He's also featured in the current film The Quick and the Dead. Our interview was recorded in 1992. More interviews from our archives next week at this time. This is Fresh Air. Welfare reform passed the House today. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what will you have on that vote on All Things Considered?
We have Brian Naylor on the Hill covering the vote. The bill passed along party lines, pretty much as the Contract with America drafted it. Now it goes to the Senate. We'll also be talking about that bill and other elements of the Contract with America with Elizabeth Arnold and Major Garrett for our regular Friday chat about politics and legislation and what's going on. Also, Mara Liasson has a piece on the president's witness testifying on affirmative action and the president's plans for that. And we have a piece from Chicago on children and the O.J. Simpson trial.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The director, Steve Gyllenhaal, first made his name with the cable TV movie Paris Trout before going on to film Waterland in 1992. The next year, he teamed up with his screenwriter wife, Naomi Foner, to make the Deborah Winger film A Dangerous Woman. And now Gyllenhaal and Foner have joined forces again. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Losing Isaiah.
What first struck me about this movie were the newspaper ads. They didn't look like ads for a feature film. They looked like ads for a TV movie. Bigger than the names of the stars, Jessica Lange and Halle Berry, even bigger than the title, was the strangely awkward come-on line. Who decides what makes a mother? The whole thing could have been ripped from the pages of TV Guide. There are exceptions, of course, but in general, feature films and TV movies are two different animals. The feature film aims to give you a distinctive, transporting experience with its own particular flavor. It aims to take you out of your world and suck you into its own. A TV movie aims for almost the opposite. It tries to be generic, with characters that are almost purposely undistinctive, so that we can all ask ourselves, what if this were happening to me? The feature film is about the world it creates. The TV movie is about the problem it wants to discuss, which makes Losing Isaiah a lot like a TV movie. Its characters, for instance, are pretty much generic. There's Jessica Lange as Margaret, the fading social worker wife of an affluent building contractor. With her only daughter reaching teenhood and her husband coming home suspiciously late from work, she's beginning to feel a bit unneeded, which helps explain why she falls head over heels for a black crack baby she sees at the hospital where she works. In fact, after a search for little Isaiah's mother proves futile, Lang and her family adopt him. But Isaiah's mom hasn't disappeared. She's a down-and-out prostitute played by Halle Berry, who one night left her newborn in a dumpster. As the movie proceeds, we watch two parallel stories, the one about how Lang and her family build a loving home around Isaiah, and the one about how Berry cleans up her act, finds a job, and then meets a lawyer, played by Samuel L. Jackson, who wants to help her get her baby back. The movie heads where you always knew it was going, to court, and inevitably to a big speechy scene with Lang on the witness stand and Jackson cross-examining her.
What we should be thinking about here is what is going to happen to the spirit of this little boy. If he's taken away from us.
So what you're saying is you're his only hope.
What I'm saying is we are all he knows. And if you take him away from us, it'll kill him.
So only you can save him. You're the great white hope.
No. But I am his mother.
Are you?
In TV movies, speech-making often substitutes for good storytelling, but it doesn't often here. Losing Isaiah is directed like a real movie, with supple camera work and smart editing. And its refusal to opt for easy answers, at least until the very unsatisfying finish, is downright bracing. Jessica Lange is a real movie actress. And even playing someone as bland and washed out as Margaret, she's an overwhelming emotional presence. Halle Berry can't quite keep up with her. She fulfills the familiar TV movie function of a glamour goddess trying on a down-and-dirty role. The paradigm is Farrah Fawcett in The Burning Bed. In a movie theater, Berry's limitations are all too obvious. And the same, finally, I'm afraid, might be said for the whole film. Someone at Paramount has made a big marketing mistake here. On the big screen, losing Isaiah looks oddly stunted and pale. But from the vantage point of the living room couch, it could have been one of the most celebrated movies of the year.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Bentham, Richard Parker, Chris Fraley, and Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.